Coming up, Judy Valente reports on how teachers in Kansas are helping students resolve conflicts peacefully, using mediation to help examine and alter their behavior. And Fred DeSam Lazaro on Minnesota seminarians following the footsteps of the late St. Teresa of Calcutta. They visited the poorest of the poor, among them some with leprosy. Plus, an imam from Texas says Americans have a moral obligation to welcome refugees.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Religious groups are among those praising this week's federal appeals court decision against President Trump's temporary travel ban. Many people of faith had been protesting the ban and urging that the administration allow refugees to resettle in the U.S. This week, hundreds of prominent evangelical leaders sent a letter to Trump urging that he reconsider the ban. They acknowledged the need for safety, but said Trump's executive order failed to strike the right balance between compassion and security. Other groups also renewed objections, including the Southern Poverty Law Center, which said the ban, quote, subjects Muslims to discrimination for no reason other than their faith. Meanwhile, about 20 rabbis protesting the ban were arrested this week in New York. In Washington, Iraqi lawmaker Vian Dakhil received the prestigious Lantos Human Rights Prize for fighting against the genocide of the ancient religious community of Yazidis in Iraq. While accepting the prize at the U.S. Capitol, Dakhil spoke about the atrocities committed by ISIS. She also took the opportunity to denounce Trump's executive order.
Mr. President Donald Trump.
Al-Iraq laysa irhabi.
Iraq is not a terrorist.
نحن لسنا بإرهابيين.
Iraqis are not terrorists.
نحن أصدقاء وحلفاء.
We are friends and allies.
Trump's temporary ban on travelers from Iraq and six other majority Muslim countries had put Dakhil's own ability to attend the ceremony into question. But the State Department intervened on her behalf. Meanwhile, Pope Francis called for greater compassion for refugees. In a video message, Francis did not specifically refer to Trump or his policies, but said he was concerned large numbers of people were being abandoned. This week, the Pope also said Christians should build bridges, not walls. Pope Francis also urged special prayers on behalf of the Rohingya minority Muslim community that's facing violence and persecution in Myanmar. Two new human rights reports this week allege that up to 1,000 Rohingya may have been killed in a new army crackdown. In Bangladesh, there are growing concerns about a government plan to relocate thousands of Rohingya refugees to a remote flood-prone island. More than 60,000 Rohingya have fled from Myanmar to Bangladesh since October. The High Court of Kenya has ruled that the government may not close the world's largest refugee camp. Hundreds of thousands of refugees, mainly from Somalia, live at the Dadaab camp. The government had vowed to shut it down because of security concerns. However, the court said that would be unconstitutional. Humanitarian groups had strongly protested the plan. In this country, the Army Corps of Engineers has now approved construction of the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and a broad array of religious groups opposed the pipeline, saying it would violate sacred land and harm water supplies. The pipeline was put on hold under the Obama administration, but 2 weeks ago, Trump ordered a new expedited review. Several cities, including Oakland, California, Minneapolis, and some communities around Denver, have adopted restorative justice and conflict resolution circles to help resolve conflicts in schools. These circles are built on principles with roots in Quaker, Mennonite, and Native American beliefs. Judy Valente tells us about two schools in Kansas where administrators hope to expand the program statewide.
When he first began teaching at Eisenhower Middle School in Topeka 3 years ago, John Dunnigan was astounded at the number of times the school's 6th, 7th, and 8th graders were sent to the principal's office for fighting with teachers or with each other and other disruptive behavior.
They go to the office, they would say, "Don't do that again," and be sent back to class. The kid was still angry. They'd pop off again, then they'd get sent right back out. The unbelievable part about it is that by the end of that year, we'd sent kids out of class 5,200 times. Just a nonstop revolving door.
The staff at Eisenhower decided to do something about that revolving door. Now, when behavior problems arise, students participate in a conflict resolution circle that includes the teacher, a mediator, and sometimes their parents. In the center of America's heartland, Eisenhower is part of a growing trend across the nation to help students learn techniques for peacefully resolving conflict. These schools also practice restorative justice. It's a form of mediation that helps students examine and alter their behavior as opposed to punishing them.
Schools play such a disproportionate impact in our young people's lives. There's the family, there's the community, but how many hours are we spending in schools? And so what happens within that school setting, I think, is that much more important.
Sharon Niss is with the Kansas Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution, which trains teachers in restorative justice practices. Restorative justice peace circles have roots in Native American, Quaker, and Mennonite spirituality. But in the public schools, the process is simply called a circle to avoid any religious connotation.
This is our talking piece. This is a symbol that we'll focus on.
So we do have a talking piece. So the only person talking is the one with the piece. And the other people's job is just to listen. And that's what kids want most of all, is just a chance for their voice to be heard, for them to have a chance to say how they're feeling in class. And we believe very much that that's an important thing.
The opportunity for restorative justice comes in when students sign an agreement about how they will resolve the conflict that has arisen or repair the relationship that's been harmed.
And we write that down in an agreement. And that agreement is sent home to the parents. The teacher keeps a copy of that agreement. And the student keeps a copy of that agreement. And if at any time either one of them thinks the other side's not holding to the agreement, they come back to me and say, "We need to meet again in circle."
At Eisenhower and other schools, these practices have replaced zero-tolerance policies that result in the suspension or expulsion of students for a variety of infractions.
If we know as schools that every time we suspend a child for non-dangerous chronic misbehaviors, that we're increasing the chance of them ending up in that juvenile justice system or the justice system in general, we're not doing them any service.
Topeka is a city divided between a more affluent west side and a struggling east side where Eisenhower is located. About 86% of Eisenhower students qualify for free breakfast and lunch. Topeka's crime rate is higher than that of Kansas and the nation as a whole. Keeping students out of the schools to prison pipeline is a major concern.
Drugs, weapons, being a danger to our other students. Yes, you should be suspended for those. But in that, we want to make sure that we're teaching you something, because just suspending you is not going to get the result. It's just going to give you the opportunity to do it over again.
Since Eisenhower began using these practices 3 years ago, the number of fights has dropped dramatically. Attendance is up, and so is academic performance.
I believe it was helpful to know that all his teachers are there for him and willing to help him and willing to give their time for him.
Seventh grader Deshaun Perry and his mother both seemed surprised and pleased at how things had gone after participating in a circle with Deshaun's teacher about his disruptive classroom behavior.
What about when they said all those nice things about you? How did that make you feel?
Happy and actually surprised.
About a 2-hour drive from Eisenhower is Wichita West High School. Wichita West began using restorative justice practices to deal with its problems 6 years ago.
Are you a clinical psychologist?
Dr. Janet Fox Peterson is the school psychologist.
We have known students who've been murdered by guns. We have known students who have committed crimes with guns. We have every challenge that a larger city has.
Expulsions have decreased 50% at Wichita West. Attendance, test scores, and enrollment have improved.
What's your observation about disrespectful language in our space at West High?
Now the school uses circles not only for conflict resolution, but also to foster a better sense of community and help students solve problems before they get out of hand.
Like, to make people want to change, you have to be changed yourself.
As at many schools, incidents of bullying and hate speech spiked at Wichita West just after Donald Trump's election. Fox Peterson says the school is not only trying to improve students' interpersonal skills, but help them become better citizens as well.
Conflict is a part of the human experience, and teaching the speaking and listening is so very critical, and we're not working on that very much as a society.
To be sure, the high school still has a fully armed city police officer assigned here throughout the school day.
So his role primary is relationship building, community building, and support of the work that we're doing in restorative justice.
So what I would appreciate from you, Deshaun,
the teachers at both Eisenhower and Wichita West say their ultimate aim is to equip students with the tools to make good choices about their lives inside and outside of school.
I believe it takes a village to raise a child. And so there are things that are being taught at home, there's things that are being taught at school, there's things that are being taught in the community, and we're trying to do this as a group.
And ultimately, it is the students who want to be safe at school and need to feel wanted there.
I wake up every day in the morning, I'm like, yeah, let's go to school, let's do all this and everything. And I'm like, hopefully there's no conflict between anybody.
As another school day ends, students head out in buses and cars. Their teachers say they hope they will carry with them the skills to be peacemakers, not only in their homes, but also in their neighborhoods. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente.
Now, a special report from Fred DeSam Lazaro on Catholic seminarians from Minnesota visiting Kolkata to see for themselves the poorest of the poor. St. Teresa became known worldwide for caring for them. The visitors saw the selflessness of the nuns carrying on her work, including with leprosy patients.
2 decades after Mother Teresa's death, the daily procession of admirers and worshipers hasn't abated at the Mother House of the Missionaries of Charity. If anything, it's ticked upward after her canonization.
Let us pray.
We followed a group of students from St. John Vianney Seminary in Minnesota, whose 10-day visit to Kolkata was funded by a private Minneapolis benefactor.
The mission was for, at least for me, is to dive deeper into the life of Mother Teresa and to see a little bit more about how she lived.
They came to immerse themselves in the work of the diminutive Albanian-born nun who founded one of the most recognizable faith-based charities, 4,500 nuns and priests in 700 centers on 5 continents. Kolkata, the crowded megacity where it all began, has always loomed large in their work, its poverty still vividly on display in some neighborhoods, jarring first-time visitors like the Midwest seminarians traveling on this day to a leprosy center.
The horns of the cars that ring in your head throughout the night, all these dogs, the smells in the air that just kind of smack you right in the face and you're not able to get away from them in any way.
It's been kind of hard to grapple with. You see it, but it kind of feels like a movie in a lot of ways. So it's not very real.
Before coming here, for example, most had no idea that Hansen's disease or leprosy is still around. Antibiotics can cure Hansen's disease, but not the stigma.
So everybody working was a former patient.
Patients and their families live in this large complex started by the Missionaries of Charity, producing crafts and textiles to earn an income.
The sisters don't go out and try to fix the society. They really embrace the culture that they're in. They find people the absolute poorest of the poor. It's what's so different about Mother Teresa is she doesn't go and try to fix all the problems in the world. She goes out to love, to bring love into the problems of the world.
For Mother Teresa's critics, that approach had serious shortcomings, one which they said treated symptoms of poverty, not the disease.
One of the criticisms leveled at Mother Teresa's organization years ago was that it was providing substandard medical care to the sick and to the dying in their facilities. In response, the sisters agreed to make improvements. However, cameras have not been allowed for years into Missionaries of Charity facilities.
Missionaries of Charity has long shunned the media spotlight and did not respond to our request to film and for an interview. The organization's finances are not disclosed publicly, critics say, and recently it stopped placing children in its care up for adoption after Indian law made single people eligible to adopt. A spokeswoman expressed concern the children could end up in gay households. Mother Teresa often swam against social tides, but stayed true to her beliefs, says journalist Sandeep Roy.
She was a Catholic nun, and that dogma was part of her calling. If she was not, you know, if she was much more pro-gay or pro-choice or all of those things that we associate, you know, with progressivism, she would not be Mother Teresa, the Catholic nun.
That calling included a vow of poverty and service to the poor and the suffering, and Roy says that may inform the order's approach to its mission.
There is a certain perception of a nobility in suffering too, which is not necessarily how we would judge the metric that we would use to judge the quality of service being offered.
I came to India in 1956, but she was one of the first people that I met. There was a holiness about her, which at the time struck me as being that she was different to other people.
Sister Cyril Mooney, a veteran Kolkata missionary and educator, was a friend of Mother Teresa, who sent many poor children to schools run by Mooney's Loreto Order. She says Mother Teresa's laser-sharp focus on the very poorest might explain why her services and facilities are Spartan and simple, a refuge for those on society's most desperate margins.
Her argument was that if we give them very good care, they gradually all the well-off people will crowd in and take over. That was an argument, yeah. Which I don't
agree
with.
You sound skeptical about that.
Oh yes, I am very skeptical about many of these things. But you can be skeptical about one's methods of procedure and not necessarily be skeptical about the results.
I mean, you really are an admirer of her, but not quite of some of the methods.
The methods, I admire her for her courage, her humility, her way of doing things in the sense of getting what she wanted and so on, but for other people, never for herself.
It's that selflessness that the Minnesota seminarians say most impressed them during a week of visiting and volunteering at Missionaries of Charity facilities.
We do our volunteer work for a couple hours and we come back absolutely exhausted. We've only been here for like 6 days, but it's taken a toll on all of us. Just to see the sisters though, for all of us, how this is their life.
I thought that 2 hours was a long time, but it really seems like it when your hands are getting really, really raw, and just that type of service, it really reminds me to be intentional with my actions and to be mindful of the people that I'm serving, even though it's indirect.
I want to really encourage my future parishioners to go to the quote-unquote other side of the tracks, to break free of the comfortable suburban sanctuaries that we've built, and to really engage in what reality is. And that way, we can really learn to build up the body of Christ.
There's so many people here that may be poor financially and monetarily, but they're so rich in so many other areas of their life that it just elevates us to become try to be better versions of ourselves.
Simplicity has always attracted me because I think of simplicity as a material simplicity, being as the missionaries are, they're intentionally poor. They make their lives simple so that they can be free to serve others.
but also I think that penetrates deeper to the disposition to serve in terms of singleness of purpose.
And we are very blessed to...
It will make me a better priest by simply recognizing how uncomfortable I am in difficult situations and turning more and more to the Lord and asking the Lord to walk me through them. And just and so recognizing that and asking for myself for that grace to be far more generous.
Even as the missionaries of charity keep their public profile low, their founder remains a towering figure here and around the world, drawing pilgrims, priests, and would-be priests to the city that in her canonization became part of her name. At the headquarters of St. Teresa of Calcutta, this is Fred de San Lazaro for Religion and Ethics News Weekly.
Amid all the political wrangling over Trump's temporary ban on refugees, we have a religious perspective today. North Texas Imam Omar Suleiman of the Yaqeen Institute for Islamic Research recently took humanitarian aid to Syrian refugee camps on the Jordan-Syria border. He spoke with us about his belief that Americans have a moral obligation to see refugees as human beings deserving peace and dignity.
The first time I went to visit the refugee camps was actually in the summer, and it was an eye-opening experience. We actually took youth groups from the United States to connect ourselves with the refugees that are on the Jordanian-Syrian border. I wanted to help them develop a sense of empathy. And as I told those young people, they expect you to be their voice. They expect you to lobby for them. They expect you to tell their stories for them. And so many of these people are so desperate just to have their stories heard. I went with Helping Hand for Relief and Development. Not only do they deliver aid to the Syrian refugees, but they actually deliver micro homes, so these little trailer homes, to those that have been there the longest. So the families that are in most need actually get trailer homes, these little small two-bedroom trailer homes. For me, that project was so unique and it was so life-changing because you could protect people from the elements. And then I went by myself in the winter to deliver those trailer homes and to actually hand deliver those blankets and those jackets that were collected here in Dallas, Texas. Going there and seeing, you know, these innocent women and children literally freezing to death was beyond heartbreaking. It was tragic. It was a catastrophe, and it's not something that you can really put into words. Unless you actually go there and connect yourself with those people, it's really hard to imagine what those elements are like. You're seeing people that are without proper blankets, even without proper jackets, without proper footwear, who will do anything to bear the harshness of the cold. It opened my eyes to the neglect of the Syrian people. We're over here debating whether or not they're human enough to be accepted in our country and to be resettled in different places in the world. We're over here debating whether or not they are barbaric or inherently violent. And they're just trying to fight to live. From a spiritual perspective, I no longer feel entitled to anything. I no longer feel like I can complain about anything in life. So a great sense of gratitude. But then just from a sense of obligation, it's one thing to see people through a Facebook video. It's another thing to sit with them. It's another thing to actually see the conditions and experience the conditions that they are living in. So once you actually have that experience, I think that your dedication to that cause rises infinitely. We have an obligation to make things better for the people over there. So whether that's pressuring the Assad regime that we will not allow you to continue to butcher your people, and instead of taking out our anger on the refugees that are being resettled around the world that are just trying to live, we actually show our anger towards those that are making them into refugees. We cannot continue to speak about these people like they're essentially not people. They're human beings. And so they have a right to live in peace and in security. And if we're not contributing to the betterment of their situation, then we ourselves need to question ourselves about who we are as Americans, who we claim to be. Are we really the moral standard for the world? And so my job is to continue to connect people at a human level and to bring people together. And from a spiritual perspective, I have an individual obligation to those people. And I have a collective, we have a collective obligation to our society and to our country and to our world to bring people together and to unite them at a human level.
Finally, on our calendar this week, the Jewish holiday Tu B'Shvat, also known as the New Year of the Trees. Tens of thousands of trees are planted every year in Israel in celebration. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.